Our topic are UFOs, UAPs, ETs, and angels. And UFOs, you're probably familiar with that. That's unidentified flying objects. And that was the expression that was used really beginning in the early 50s to really the last 10 years or so, where it changed to UAPs, which are unidentified aerial phenomena. And I'll talk a little bit about why there was this rebranding of it. ETs are, you know, extraterrestrials, and angels, of course, you all know about them. The whole UFO phenomenon started in the late 1940s, and there were then investigations. The Air Force, you know, started a major program to try to figure out what was going on, and it led to the whole area of what was labeled ufology, you know, the study of unidentified flying objects. And then it came to 1977, which is when it caught my attention, when I went to see this movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And those of my generation, I see your heads, you know, bobbing up and down. I don't know how many of the millennials and the subsequent generations, you know, have seen this movie. When I went to see it at the theater, all I know was everybody was going to see it and talking about it, and the title made no sense to me. You know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which presumes there would have been a close encounter of the second kind, a close encounter of the first kind, and as I looked into it further, I found there were even other things, other times associated with it, and beyond even the third kind of encounters. And that particular terminology was developed by this man here, J. Allen Hynek. He was an astronomer at Ohio State and began, you know, with a very good reputation to look at these unidentified type of experiences and phenomena. And he developed what's called the Hynek scale. And he classified, in essence, in UFO close encounters. And this is the scale that he developed. Looks like you can pick up a little bit of that. I'll explain these categories that he came up with. Even before he got into the first kind, second kind, and third kind, he said that there were first nocturnal lights, UFOs that just appears at lights, you know, typically round with no obvious structure. And just the lights that you see floating around. And there's a place in Texas that's well known for its moving lights, you know, there, and there's natural explanation for it, but it became a famous place. Then there are daylight disks, originally defined as a daytime report of an oval or disk-shaped object that did not appear as any conventional aircraft or other known objects. And then there were all these radar visual sightings that included radar detections, blips, you know, on the radar screen, but unexplained and not verified as to what they possibly, you know, could have been. And those radar visuals typically involved the military as well, you know, aircrafts and others, you know, having those blips, you know, come up on their screens. Now, there were three types of close encounter categories in Hynek's system, and the fourth that was added later. Close encounters of the first kind. those who are sighting where the UFO, whatever its appearance comes near enough to a witness. Typically, what he said, within about 500 feet, and the details of the UFO could be readily observed, but there was no interaction with the witness or the environment. So you could see something, a disc shape, you know, something, even a metallic type of thing, but yet no direct interaction occurring. Then you come to the close encounters of the second kind. And those are the sightings where the UFOs cause an effect on the environment or on the witnesses or animals. And if you ever saw the close encounters of the third kind, that's how the movie opens. You know, there's this truck that drives down the road and then gets stuck on a railroad track and starts shaking and everything, and the animals around, you know, are terrified and everything. The man sitting inside the truck, you know, just scared to death, you know, there too. So that's the second kind. There's some kind, you know, of interaction going on. Now, close encounters of the third kind that leads through the movie and to the end of the movie, sightings where an entity of subtype or whatever the appearance was seen in or near the UFO. And going back to the movie, some of you may recognize what this, even though it was a sighting in Wisconsin. This is Devil's Tower in Wisconsin that they used for the movie. There where towards the end, there's actually a UFO that comes down and people are having some kind of interaction with these strange-looking beings. And Hynek himself, you know, was an extra in the movie, and he appeared just as a scientist, you know, witnessing, you know, this event of the encounters of close encounters of the third kind. And he went on, you know, to, of course, to write a book about it and everything that was very much part of the ufology, you know, of the times too. And he even went to Harvard, you know, to teach a seminar on all of that and too. But he died, I think, in the mid-1980s. He didn't get paid much for his terminology being used for the movie, I think. I read that he only got paid $1,000 for the expression encounters of the third type, you know, to be used in the movie. But then we come to 1982. This was the great movie of 1982, E.T., you know. And what was the expression that E.T. used? E.T., go home. Gone, E.T., gone home. Oh, phone, okay. It's been a while since I've, but you all, at least my generation knows it, you know, pretty well. And you probably heard of entering Area 51, ostensibly closed off, you know, to the public, the reputed site of a crash or special experimentation going on, and perhaps an actual saucer, you know, being there along with the deceased bodies of actual ETs. So we are told, too. Project Blue Book was a project that was begun and then discontinued, but to try to see what was possibly, you know, happening with all of these different claims, you know, sightings and experiences too, but all kept top secret too. And there was a movie called Project Blue Book, not as big as E.T. or and close encounters of the third kind. Some of you might have followed this. That was a hit series in the 1990s, the X-Files. Some of you may even know, you know, what are the names of these two, you know, FBI agents that... Okay, there you go. Agents Mulder and Scully. too. And this was a best-selling book. 45 million copies sold. Chariots of the Gods, you know, Eric von Däniken, and made all kinds of claims, like perhaps the pyramids, you know, were built by extra, you know, terrestrials that used their technology to enable, you know, the Egyptians and others to build pyramid-like structures, you know, all over the world, and that too. And this is a government project, and still going on. This is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And if you ever driven, you know, down to New Mexico and everything, you may have gone across, you know, this field of radio satellites, just to try to see, you know, there's radio signals that are made discernible as language, you know, perhaps. So far, they haven't really, you know, found anything, too. But, you know, currently on the History Channel, you can watch Ancient Aliens. Now, I watched a couple episodes there, and they were really just making a whole lot of very little. And one of the segments I watched is what they thought, you know, is what the Ark of the Covenant is all about. And according to Ancient Aliens on the History Channel, the Ark of the Covenant is actually just a small nuclear reactor, you know, that Ancient Aliens, you know, enabled the Israelites, you know, to develop too. And really, they spend a whole hour, you know, on this as a possibility. So it began as an unidentified flying object, but a rebranding occurred, changing from unidentified flying objects to unidentified aerial phenomena, UAP, sometimes also unidentified anomalous phenomena. And it's the official term that's used now to describe objects detected in the air, in the sea or space that defy easy explanation. UFO originated in 1952, and I don't have an exact date when this rebranding occurred, but it occurred sometime, I think, within the last 10 years, where it began to be used. And this last year, you know, there were congressional hearings and release of information by the government and release of footage of you know, pilots, you know, queuing in on these objects, which were moving at fantastic speeds in comparison to how they were, you know, moving and making sudden turns, you know, going from a complete horizontal velocity and making a sudden horizontal turn and flying off in seconds, you know, entirely out of sight. And they could provide no explanation, you know, for that, but, you know, they had them on boxes, and you may have seen some of those clips, you know, occurring. Here's just it's one shot, and this is a release of the U.S. you know, government on that. And I didn't have a video of it, you know, take a video of it to put on, but this is just a screenshot of something they had. And four years ago, in 2021. Was when the government released this preliminary assessment of unidentified aerial phenomena. And this is from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. It's a 10-page summary, and you can Google it, and it will immediately come up, and you can print it off, you know, if you'd like. This was classified at one time. This could only be found in Joe Biden's garage at one time, but it's accessible, you know, to everyone at this time. And I've, you know, basically I I highlighted just two short paragraphs that really summarizes just 10 pages, you know, as a whole. And this is what they said. Most of the UAP reported probably do represent physical objects, given that a majority of UAP were registered across multiple sensors to include radar, infrared, electro-optical, weapon seekers, and visual observations. But UAP incidents really fall into one of five explanatory categories: airborne clutter, natural atmospheric phenomena, U.S. industry developmental programs, foreign adversary systems, and a catch-all other bin. And other just means we don't know what this is, but there's something, out there too. But this makes good, good, interesting reading. And this was released in with some of the congressional oversight, aspect where they asked for it, and finally they got this release from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Does the Bible say anything about unidentified aerial phenomena or extra terrestrials? There are biblical descriptions of spiritual beings that we see all the way through Scripture, from the book of Genesis to the book of Revelation. What's the first spiritual being that we are introduced to in the book of Genesis? In chapter 3, of course, it's first of all the serpent, but that's kind of Satan, the devil, the serpent of old, masqueraded himself, through that. But who guarded the entry to the Garden of Eden once Adam and Eve were escorted out, or as some translations say, expelled out? But I think it was a gentle escort out, that they had, after the promises that were made and all. But it was a cherubim and then a flaming sword, as well, there. And the cherubim then surfaces later, with the construction of the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant, and then with the temple and cherubim there in Solomon's temple, in the gold and in the curtain and everything. But again, the cherubim, the first, and I'm sure a being that Adam and Eve, were rather wary, of, even as they still came to worship, as we saw Abel, would at the probably near the entryway of the Garden of Eden at that time. And then we go on in the book of Genesis. Jacob had an unusual encounter, as he was fleeing and came to the place where he will call Bethel, the house of God, because there, when he had fallen asleep, what did he see? New King James says there was a ladder with angels, ascending and descending there. And then when Elijah was separated from Elisha before he was taken up by a whirlwind, what was it that came that separated the two of them? Says simply called a chariot of fire. And this is how one illustrator sees it. And then later with Elisha himself, as he and his servant, and the group came to arrest them and everything. What did he say? He asked God to open his servant's eyes to what? To see that those who are with us are greater than those who are with them. And we're told there were fiery, horses and chariots, that appeared, all around them. And then we come to, I'm skipping now, very large portions of Scripture, but in Isaiah, you know, chapter 6, verses 2 and 3, who are these, you know, spirit beings? These are called seraphim, and we're told they had six wings. Two of them, they covered their head and all. But the seraphim just means burning ones. And sometimes angels are described, you know, as such, and special ministers, you know, of God, but describes as flames, you know, sometimes as well. We come to Ezekiel, and this is probably the one chapter in the scriptures that gives us the greatest not explanation but description, you know, of certain spirit beings, and here they are called the four living creatures, and they reappear in Revelation chapter 4 and chapter 5 as well. But these living creatures in the book of Ezekiel, you know, are described as having, they do have four wings, and they also have four faces. You know, a face like a man, a face like an ox, a face like a lion, a face like an eagle. And all in for this individual living creatures. A slightly different description is given in Revelation of them, where they're described as individually, separately, having a face of a lion, one having a face of a lion, one having the face of an ox, and so on. And associated with them were what? No, wheels within wheels, you know, that moved along with them. And those wheels within wheels had eyes, you know, as well. So one illustrator's view, you know, of it too. But incredible, these are living, associated with the living creatures here, and all associated also, you know, with the throne, I think, sitting on a throne here. It's probably the pre-incarnate Christ, as is, I think, described there in Ezekiel chapter 1. And that's Ezekiel kind of sitting in front of it, you know, totally, you know, overwhelmed as this appeared, you know, to him. And this is the glory that was there, you know, in associated with the temple, and that then departed, you know, from the temple to the Mount of Olives, and then left, you know, all together. And we come to Ezekiel 28, and this is the anointed cherub, and this is Satan, the anointed cherub, probably a cherubim, and maybe the chief, you know, of the cherubim before sin arose, no, within him. And he's also called Lucifer in Isaiah 14, verse 14, the light bearer there. And we're told in 2 Corinthians 11, 14 that even now he disguises himself as an angel of light too. So we come to, again, other scriptures. We see all of these spiritual beings, and they seem to be, at least many of them, differentiated from each other. We have angels and cherubim and archangels and seraphim. 1 Corinthians, Ephesians 1, 21, 6, 12, Colossians 1, 16 refers to powers and principalities. Colossians to thrones and rulers and all. So again, angels are ministering spirits and sent to us according to help those who will inherit the reward of ruling with Christ, to be companions of Christ. They come to render special aid 2, and Hebrews chapter 13 tells us that some have entertained angels unaware. And so we should practice hospitality, much as Abraham did when these three figures came to him. One he recognized, I think, as the pre-incarnate Christ that had appeared to him before, but that time accompanied by two others. And when they came, he prepared a fatted calf, for them. And they sat down, they ate with him, and so forth. And even for now, we're told that in the heavenly Jerusalem, which we go to be present with the Lord, I think before the rapture even, but we're told there are myriads and myriads of angels there in Hebrews 12, verses 18 to 24, and all. And then again, we come to Revelation, to the matter of the four living beings and the living creatures. And we are told, about this. Every now and then the veil is lifted to us concerning the whole host of spiritual beings that are involved in the affairs of this world. Daniel chapter 10, gives a glimpse of that. And I think Revelation 12 gives us in summary form, that whole history of angelic, influence in this world, both Michael and his angels and the devil, the Satan, and his angels, and that struggle even that goes on between the archangel and the dragon. And my point in giving the summary, in essence, from Genesis to Revelation, there is an alien nature to these spiritual beings. Now, are they connected to some of the phenomena that occurs even now? Some theologians do propose that certain UAP encounters may be manifestations of spiritual beings. In the early 80s, I remember hearing I did not write down his name, and all of a sudden, the apologetics professor, he was at DCS at Southern Seminary, Norman Geisler, yes. Thank you. Ellie was here earlier talking about, and Mark, about our brains, changing a little bit. My 70-year-old brain now does go back. Go out every now and then. I'm trying to recall something, but he clearly posited himself that what was happening, even in the 80s and in popular culture and everything, he thought that was the influence of angelic beings. And later on, when he was testifying before the courts about intelligent design being taught in the school, the attorneys on the other side undermined his credibility by bringing up his quotes, on the whole matter of UFOs and everything, too. But recognizing angels as aliens in the sense of being non-human or otherworldly can offer a framework for understanding, explaining certain unexplained phenomena, but not all unexplained aerial phenomena should be attributed to spiritual beings. Angels are non-material, intelligent beings. They have no corporeal bodies, but however, under certain circumstances allowed by God, they can assume physical bodies. And again, Hebrews 13:1 says that some of you may have had an angel visiting you, just unaware of it. Now Abraham was aware of it, when they came, and they ate with him, and talked with him, and all of that. I don't think they take over an existing physical body, but perhaps they can manipulate matter so as to assume a physical appearance that is visible yet still consistent with angelic character. And not all angels are good. Fallen angels may produce remarkable phenomena. And they can produce strange phenomena, sometimes just within our minds and imaginations, if we allow it. They can manipulate, perhaps, sense perceptions. They can also produce phenomena in the outer world. They can mess with our heads. They can mess with the material world to manifest strange phenomena. So my point is, there is such a thing as extraterrestrial intelligence. And these creatures really are from another world. But they're not from Planet X out there, you know, somewhere. They're just from within the spiritual world that intersects, you know, with our world, but most of the time in a way that's not perceived, you know, by us. They're what we call angels, and some of these angels are ministers of light. Others are ministers of deception and destruction. And furthermore, these extraterrestrials are involved in a great cosmic war, and human beings are a part, you know, of this. Now, I don't think these images that we have, you know, are necessarily angelic, you know, beings, fallen or holy too. Green kind of carries a malevolent, you know, feeling, you know, too. But no, little green man. No, probably not. But there are possible connection of UAPs and spiritual beings. But I think we need to exercise a great deal of discernment and caution, you know, concerning that. And again, this report by the, you know, by the Director of National Intelligence, I think it's probably as balanced, you know, as it gets. And just leaving in the other, you know, category what they cannot explain. So going back, you know, to this schematic, as you look to the scriptures, it is incredible, you know, how much is said about, you know, angels and of all different types, and the veil is just lifted. But we're told that there is a great cosmic conflict that is going on. And during the tribulation period, after the church is taken up to be with Christ, you know, in air sky, you know, as one of our speakers, you know, as Bob Wyatt, you know, I think, you know, put it, we follow through the book of Revelation. It mentions all kinds of angelic activity that will occur that have not been permitted, you know, until then. A few examples, you know, of that. The locust from the bottomless pit in Revelation chapter 9, verses 7 through 11. Now, the description doesn't seem to fit what we see as ETs, you know today, but they seem to be some kind of demonic, perhaps creatures, of some kind that would be afflicting men, you know, people on the earth, you know, for a significant, you know, amount of time. And then we're told about the four angels that have been bound, that are currently bound at where? The Euphrates River. Now, and they will be released during the time of the tribulation too. And then, of course, Revelation chapter 12 about the dragon, who's identified as the serpent of old, as Satan, as the devil. His activity will be restricted at that time to just the earth, and he'll be wrecking havoc, he and his angels, until Jesus comes and deals with them, and Michael comes and bounds Satan in the bottomless pit, for the 1,000 years, and presumably all the fallen angels, as well, with him. But some of them are kept down now in their activity. And since I'm speaking, I can plug the class that I'll be teaching this fall. So I'll give a plug. So this fall, I'll be teaching the theology class on angelology and anthropology and hamartiology. And they're, all connected there. But if you really want to get in, we'll be having at least 4 or 5 lectures, just on angelology there and discussions, going there. But some of you may take the class, if you're going to give me a preview of the kind of questions, that you will be asking, you can bring them up here now, and that will give me further time to prepare, for the class itself this fall, too. So we still have 2 minutes to go, but we can start if you have some questions. However, we're going to do it. If just take that.
Okay. Cards, I'll take them. If not, you can just shout them out.
Yeah. So begin on this side. Yes, Bob.
When did the fall of Satan happen?
Well, I still go, I think, Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 does give us a little bit of that. But when did it occur? Two possibilities, two views, I think, that probably many of you may hold one or two, one or the other, of those views. One view is that they were part of the 7 days of creation that occurred perhaps at the very beginning, of that, and the expression in Job that as the rest of creation unfolded, they were there, the sons of God, rejoicing and praising God, for that. But the false Satan and the third of the angels that he drew with them would have occurred shortly thereafter, but before the formation of Adam and the formation of Eve from Adam. So very early, created and almost within a very short period, sin was found in the anointed, cherub, and he fell and drew the angels with him. So that's one view. Another view is that before the creation described for us in Genesis 1, and perhaps between Genesis 1, 1 and 2, this is called a modified gap, view, that there may have been, we can't give it a certain time frame to it, but there was the creation of the angels, that occurred, and there might have been a special Edenic place, for the angels, that's separate from the Garden of Eden, described for us in Genesis 2, but where Ezekiel 28 talks about the stones, the fiery stones, and all of that. Arnold Fruchtenbaum develops, this view, that there was a period of time where the angels had this special realm, and then the rebellion occurred, and that led to the kind of the chaos that the tohu v'bohu that in Genesis 1-2 now, and the earth was formless and void, and the formless and void was due to the angelic fall would be in that modified gap view.
I've sometimes wondered if the angels had been created millions of years ago. Somewhere and unrelated to the earth, or they've always been part of the earthly creation.
Yeah. And this modified gap view doesn't go for the millions and billions of years or anything. No. Arnold Fuchtenbaum is a young earth person as he views the creation and all, but there was this Edenic angelic place that that where sin then became there too. So I don't think, you know, I can rule out. I tend to lean just to that angels were created within the 70s, somewhere between the first and second day. I lean to that view, but you know, Arnold Funkenberg knows a lot more than I do, you know, too. So, and others, and I've talked to a couple of people here. They knew I was going to speak on that. They asked me, you know, what I thought, and that's probably not that could be fairly common view among free grace. But I think it has merit. Both views, I think, have merit to them. Yes.
Are you familiar with Michael Heiser's work on the unseen realm?
Yes, I've read his book. And 2 years ago, in fact, I gave as I was talking about the sons of God and the daughters of men, you know, in Genesis 6, and I referred to, you know, Michael Heiser's, you know, view there. Again, there's some good things about Michael Heiser, and again, he's a brilliant man, and I know he passed away a few years ago, you know, too, a brilliant Hebrew scholar and everything, but I think he presses things a little bit, you know, too far, and I think he relies too much on 1st and 2nd Enoch and other, you know, intertestamental books, you know, too. But, you know, the whole matter of the divine counsel and everything, I think there's some merit, you know, to it. But I think he develops it a little bit too much. And presses, you know, I think he presses too much Psalm 82, I think, to fit that scheme and all of that, too. Yes? Yeah.
So I thought that, like, guardian angels for a long time was kind of like fantasy. But someone brought up to me Matthew 18:10.
Yes, about their children's angels, you know, seeing their faces, their faces there too. That's possible that God does give, you know. Well, we do know that the archangel Michael is special guardian of the of Israel and all. Now, does every individual child have a special guardian? I think that's pressing, you know, that too much. But can God assign at certain times, you know, a special angelic protection to us or to children? I think so. There have been times in my life where things have occurred that, you know, my life was dramatically saved that I cannot account for other than God did something, you know, to. I was in the state of Delaware where Brittany and I were on staff with Campus Crusade for a number of years. And in the winter, you know, where there was ice and everything, I was driving down the road. And then I came down to just one lane, you know, on the road there. And the other lanes were blocked off. And down that one lane, all of a sudden, a large pickup truck, you know, came straight for me. And I don't remember doing anything, but all of a sudden I found myself in that separate closed off lane, you know, from that pickup truck that was heading for me. And I drove home and Brenda told me, I walked to the door and I was white, you know, and I was shaking, you know, too. And I can't explain, you know, how I survived that, you know. And I can't explain, you know, the displacement, you know, that occurred, but something, you know, happened, you know, too.